Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish Women Oral History 2. Gertrude Silverblatt and Bessie Hyman are interviewing Silas Adelsheim on November 1st, 1975. This is the third side of the tape.
We left off at this point. You said this group became the National Council to Combat Blindness, and there were 24 to 25 people involved.
It developed the Dr. Gordon's experiments. He became, at that time, the foremost authority of this disease because our effort brought many more retinitis pigmentosa patients to him from all over the world, I think. And after all, it was Cornell Medical School and the New York Hospital, and they had the reputation too. And his superior officer, his name I can't think of now, but John McLean was the head of the department, was terrific in helping Dr. Gordon expand this work. Now, unfortunately, very little benefit was gained. It did retard. I used to, after I would get my shots, I sometimes would see a little light, or think I saw light. But most of the people who were in the original group finally lost all their vision, or practically all their vision. Some still have a little bit. But it didn't seem to retard it. But we found out through that work that you cannot do research on one specific single eye disease. You have to do work on vision. And that's how the Combat Blindness then devoted its program. Now, we also found out through connections, and there were many, it started to spread, that the National Institutes of Health were just formed in 1948. That was a product of the former Surgeon General, but nothing could be done about it during the war because there was no money. That was really the beginning of the Health, Education, and Welfare Department in the government. There were seven institutes set up, National Institutes of Health. Well, they had mental health, they had cancer, they had heart, they had dental, they had everything but vision. For 2 years, we tried through different governmental committees and influence wherever we could to get them to add vision to the program. Finally, we went to Washington, we were allowed an audience. So we had Dr. Gordon, who was the foremost man that we knew medically, and Dr. Daniel Poling, P-O-L-L-I-N-G, who was editor of the Christian Herald, well-known man whose wife had the disease, J.M. Ulmer of Cleveland, a fine lawyer who I met in the hospital when I had the cataract operation. We don't need to go into that. And there was a young sports writer out of Boston whose child had it, and there was a number of others appeared before the Committee of Washington. Peggy read my testimony, and at that time, President Senator Scott from Pennsylvania was on the committee, and I remember him saying, after he complimented Peggy on her rendition and said that, told us that his mother had visual trouble, and he was very much interested. consequently, we take credit for having blindness added to the seventh, the last institute, the National Institute of Health. It was then the National Institute for Neurological Diseases, and they added end blindness. Now, that was great. That was an achievement.
And that was in what year?
That was in 48. Mildred was received at the White House. One of our supporters was an Attorney General Powers of Connecticut, who was blind, and he had some influence there, and he arranged a setup for Mildred with President Truman. We have pictures that were in the Post. Drew Pearson wrote it out. And we got a lot of good publicity. We were supposed, under the articles, to get 25% of the funds for vision research. We were...
Of what funds?
Of the funds that the government, the federal government, gave the National Institute of Health.
You would get 25% of the of all of the funds, or 25% of the funds for your neurological?
Of the funds that were allotted to the National Institute for Neurological Diseases for blindness. Blindness would be allowed 25% for their program and research. And they didn't know where to start. Remember, it was just a couple of years after the war. At that time, it's hard to believe this. This is positively a fact. You didn't have enough ophthalmologists, registered ophthalmologists, for one for every county in this country. They had opticians and optometrists, but not ophthalmologists, the eye surgeons. We had to do something to develop the interest in that. And one of our doctors, Dr. Philip Tigerson, from the Proctor Foundation of San Francisco, came up with an idea to offer student fellowships. Take junior and senior college students and offer them a summer fellowship to do laboratory work during the summer period, where they can make, I think we started with $500 for the summer. And perhaps we could interest some of them to go into the field of ophthalmology.
Where did they work, and where was the lab?
They wherever college or institution they were. They were all in college. They were all students in college, and maybe they were studying chemistry or physics or medicine. We tried to get them in the lab to work with some of the people on an eye project. They had to submit the project to be approved by the head of the department, to be approved by our scientific advisory committee.
But it worked. Did every project have to be something related to the eye?
Not specifically, because we tried to support pilot projects that might lead to that. They didn't know where they were going in those days. What they were trying to do was to get people interested in research, and primarily ophthalmological research. But it developed that the next step was to get full-time fellowships for graduates who wanted, maybe a man was a general practitioner that wanted to go into ophthalmology, but he wanted to find out what it was all about. So we developed that program, and then we added the grants and aid. We didn't have that much money in those days. I think the first year we gave any money away was 1950. That's the National Council to Combat Blindness. In the meantime, the National Institute of Health is just getting organized too. They didn't know what it was all about either, but they had many more experts than we had, because they were drawing from all over the country and perhaps the world.
But these fellowships that you were talking about, the summer grants that you gave the students, was that from the...
Not, we were trying to develop a program for them. See, they were supposed to do their research work at their different institutions wherever they could. They were They were seeking applications. They were looking for projects. The ophthalmologist, the guy, let's say a man that just got out of the Army, where he'd been for 3 or 4 years, or just graduated medical school, he wasn't interested in going into a research lab. He wanted to start practice. He probably was married, maybe had children. He wanted to make money.
I don't quite understand. Did the organization to combat blindness try to develop programs for national health?
Yes, yes, yes. We did. Because we were closer to the field through our scientific advisory committee than they were in getting started. But we started small, turned our programs over to them to expand, which eventually happened. But as the years went by, I want to make this short because it could go on and on and on. We found out that the 25% of the funds, which was supposed to be going into grants for vision research, we were not getting. So we started then trying to form our own eye institute. It took us, I would say, from 1965 to form the National Eye Institute, an additional institute under the National Institutes of Health, under Health Education.
Where did you get the money for all your pilot programs?
Public funds. Albert and Mary Lasker, who have a wonderful reputation as philanthropists in the health field, helped very much. Not only did they make contributions in sizable amounts, but we had the Mary Lasker Award for $500 a year, which in those days seemed like a lot of money, to the ophthalmologist. Wrote the most outstanding paper that was presented to their Association for Research in Ophthalmology and Blindness. That helped. And all of us interested solicited. I send out one solicitation a year on Thanksgiving, and I've been very successful. Many people, friends, associates, business people who know me and who are interested in the cause make annual contributions. And everybody who is a member of the organization do something similar. And we that has spread and has grown. And early this year, the Marsh Foundation in New York gave us a $100,000 contribution in memory of the son of one of the founders, Lester Marsh.
Is there a difference between Fight for Sight and Combat Blindness?
No, that was, as we got older, that was a trademark, Fight for Sight. Instead of National Council of Combat Blindness, which was a long name, somehow we got in there, Fight for Sight. And they were using that more because it's very explicit, isn't it, in what we're trying to do, Fight for Sight. And it's short, it's catchy. Although we still have our original charter. Is under the National Council of Combat.
Now, you were one of the originators of
this. We were one of the founders.
You were one of the founders. Are you still very active in it?
I'm still chairman of the board. After being on the board for a while, I was made president. After a number of years of president, I was made chairman of the board, and I'm still chairman of the board of that. And I keep close contact with the organization. I always attend the meeting of our scientific advisory committee, who is composed of many, many outstanding ophthalmologists and scientists, some of the leaders in the field. And it's always very interesting. You never have enough money for all the applications. Every year we receive more funds, but more applications too.
Are you only interested in children? Or adults?
We're interested. That's another phase of the program. I'm glad you mentioned it. It was suggested maybe 10 years ago that what can we do to help the children now? Our chairman is Dr. Charles Pereira, who is former head of the Department of Columbia Presbyterian in New York. We worked out what they call the Fight for Sight Children's Eye Clinic for Columbia. Now the main idea was this information was given to us not only by Dr. Pereira, but by leading pediatric physicians and philosophers and so on, do something to affect the children. So what they did, murals, kids' pictures, they got small tables and small chairs, they had toys, they had coloring books, things like that. So when a child came to the clinic for examination, they weren't frightened. It wasn't like going to a doctor's office.
When you say the clinic, are you talking to one about one particular clinic?
I'm talking about only the Fight for Sight Eye Clinic. You know, it's tough to take children to a doctor's office. Everybody's experienced that. But when they brought them in for eye checkup or anything was wrong with the child, they came to the children's eye clinic.
Well, how many clinics are there?
Now there are four. The second one was opened in Will's Eye Hospital in Philadelphia. Then there was one opened here at the Eye and Ear Hospital in Pittsburgh about 5-6 years ago. And another one in New York, New Jersey.
How does Fight for Sight work with the health and welfare on financially?
We don't with health and welfare.
I'm talking about the.
We finance all our own student fellowships, full time. Fellowships and grants and aids and these clinics. We do that ourselves. We get no money from that, from the federal government. They have their own program. Now, since we have the National Eye Institute, this is too long, too complicated.
This is very interesting.
But it's a great thing, and we're very proud that we were able to finally get a National Eye Institute established. A grand coincidence that Dr. Carl Kupfer, who is the director, was one of our former full-time fellows in research. I think he came from Oregon.
Now, is the National Eye Institute government?
Yes.
It's part of NIH.
It's part of NIH. They have added other institutes since then. I think today they have about 10. But
ten institutes
for health, public health. And of course they've been stymied in the last year too because their allocations have been reduced. But they've got a real great program, and it's going to help. It's going to help fund some of the causes and cures of blinding eye disease.
Is there anything else that you'd like to tell me about Fight for Sight or the Institute for the Blind we have not covered?
I'm very proud of the work we're doing. Many doctors tell us that we started the research ball rolling after the war, and that's true. There are other organizations that do a little give a little money to this or that. But we concentrate entirely. Our budget is 500 to 600,000, which isn't a lot compared to federal funds, which go into millions. But we concentrate on the new investigators, the people who are not known to Washington, to the heads of the department. They're the young people who may have an idea. And it's better for us to give him $5,000 to let him see what he can do with his idea. And they get $50,000 from the federal government because they won't give it to him in the first place because he's not now. But we find some of these things are paying off. They found out about Diamox. A young, happened to be a student fellow who went into ophthalmology. He and his wife developed the Diamox drops for glaucoma, which has helped considerably in the treatment of glaucoma. It's no longer the dangerous eye disease of losing your sight that it was 10 years ago.
Does Fight for Sight concentrate on research and their clinics? Is that all?
That's all. We do no rehabilitation or education. Strictly visual research. Blinding eyes. That's our whole program.
I'd like to get back to the occupation. Are you still working? Now it's gone.
I will never give up my work. President Truman was our principal speaker at the banquet, and I was very thrilled meeting him. I didn't realize what a great man he was. He came out about it. He was very plain. He was very
national board.
I had raised the temple membership of about 500 to around a fairly successful program, and I had met members of the national board. We only had two men on the national board here: Charlie Wright and Simon Ferd Weil. Anyway, I was elected in 55 as a vice president to the board, and the next year, I was elected 2 years, 57, I was elected a vice president.
What does the Brotherhood Board do besides getting members?
Oh, that's the Brotherhood Board. Encourages the local Brotherhood. I'm talking about the National Brotherhood Board. The National Brotherhood encourages the local Brotherhood Board to support their congregations, not only through worship, but financially and civically and in every other way that the congregation functions in the community. And our big program is the Jewish Chautauqua Society to combat anti-Semitism. It's a wonderful, wonderful program. Lord knows we need it badly.
Does the Jewish Chautauqua Society, is that a direct outgrowth of the Brotherhood?
Well, it was formed coincidentally by another Pittsburgh, a Dr. Porkowitz in Pittsburgh, who was a rabbi in Philadelphia. And he started originally, just like the old Chautauqua movement, he went to small congregations in the South and the North, giving sermons. That was the Chautauqua movement, just like you still have up in Chautauqua, New York. And then it developed that was unnecessary. But the society should adopt as their principal program to combat anti-Semitism, and that's the work it does today. But it does provide rabbis for college campuses so that they go there. Kids who have never seen a rabbi before see that they don't have horns and that they're intelligent people. And they go to summer camps and give courses in history or religion. Plus the fact we give libraries, Judaica, the college library, so where the will, the means is there for them to take these books, plus all the lectures that they supported, all the movies, small commercials that they had, all now the society to combat that anti-Semitism, which is just a branch of the National Federation of Temple Brothers.
Are you involved in any other community activities other than
Well, that
the
brought
Brethren?
Me closer to the temple, because I needed the temple support. I needed the support of our local brotherhood. And in 1955 or 56, we formed the Western Pennsylvania Conference of Temple Brotherhoods. It comprised 10 or 11 brotherhoods. You know, I don't know how long it's been since Sinai. Brother Sholem is the only Reformed congregation in Pittsburgh until Sinai was formed, and then Emmanuel, and then I just sort of grew out of it. And we started with those three, and there's McKeesport, Uniontown, Johnstown, Temple David at Monroeville, Coriopolis, Sharon. Anyway, we got all these brotherhoods together to try to do the same thing that Nashville was trying to do, to get men to support their congregation and to worship and to help finance these things and to work in civic projects so the Jews could take part in everything that was civic, not just religious. And it worked well. We had a wonderful convention in Pittsburgh, which was sponsored by the Western Pennsylvania Conference of Temple Brothers in 1957. And again last year.
Do you see much change in Pittsburgh or in the Jewish community in Pittsburgh over the years? From you have been very active in the temple. Do you see much change?
I see much change in our temple. I have been a member of the Board of Trustees for a period of 18 years. I just stopped last year. We finally succeeded in passing new bylaws restricting terms even of the officers as well as the board. As you know, we have a change in president of the congregation, and we'll have another one in another year or so, and the vice president. So it's no more a perpetual thing, because while we had wonderful outstanding presidents, other people were discouraged from working and participating because they felt that they should have the recognition too. And I think the change in the board and the change in officers is helping. Now, what I see change in Brother Sholem is more of the things, more Hebrew. Now, I don't say that's bad. We never had bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah until years ago. My oldest grandson, his other grandparents, one from Bar Mitzvah, Maury Davis, one Mark Adelstein Bar Mitzvah, and while Rabbi Jacob taught him, he had a Hebrew teacher, he was Bar Mitzvah at the Hebrew Institute on Denison Avenue, right there. And I had never seen a bar mitzvah. I was against it. I was uninformed. I was an uninformed Reformed Jew. I thought Hebrew was bad. I thought anything Orthodox was bad.
But you,
because I didn't have the knowledge of it. But when I saw and heard Mark's bar mitzvah 9 years ago, I then changed my viewpoint completely and helped through the temple board have bar mitzvah included at the temple. And I'm glad I did, because I see many families are taking advantage.
Well, how do you view Pittsburgh Jewish life and its place in the general community?